Now we gathered here on the universe at this time, this particular time, to listen to the 36 black notes of the piano. There's 36 black notes and 52 white notes. We don't mean to eliminate nothing, but we're gonna just hear the black notes at this time, if you don't mind. Blackness, B-L-A-C-K-N-U-S-S.
I'm on the phone with Adam Kahn, director of a documentary about Rahsaan Roland Kirk, which will be screening at the IU Cinema at 3 p.m. this Sunday, the 26th. Adam, where and when did you first hear the music of Roland Kirk?
You know, unfortunately, by the time I came to know his music, he had passed away in 1977. But in the late 80s, I just stumbled upon a record of his at a garage sale. I was living in San Francisco at the time. And at that point, I wasn't really into jazz. And I thought, wow, I should check out jazz, you know, quote-unquote jazz. So I didn't know anything, and I just bought a record of his, which was just had a headshot. It was an Atlantic Records kind of greatest hits or best of. So there was no visual cue as to kind of the real innovation and magic that I was going to get into, but it was just a headshot of Rahsaan. I bought that and a Louis Armstrong record and a Count Basie record, you know, and those guys are huge, but it was the Rahsaan record that really just hooked me immediately.
Well, that's a pretty good trio of jazz records to pick up on your first purchase. Jazz is not really a broad enough term to categorize what he was trying to do sonically. Is that something that you dig into in the film?
Yeah, absolutely, and glad you bring that up. We talk about it in the film, some of the guys talk about it. In the film, it's really the only talking heads, quote-unquote, the people in the film are really those who are just closest to him. So it's his family, it's his son, and his last wife, Dorothon Kirk, who is kind of the keeper of the mantle at this point. Rory Kirk is in it as well, and then the only musicians in it are really people who spent time with him. So Ron Burton, his pianist, and some bass players, and Steve Turay, Mattathias Pearson, who just passed away, unfortunately. So these guys talk about, and Rahsaan talks about, you know, how just constantly being people trying to put him in a box, and marketing people trying to put jazz music in a box, and how you market music and how you market musicians as a product, and how everything he did was really exploration and innovation, and he just followed his dreams as we talk about in the film, and his inspiration. So he, you know, he wasn't going to be limited by any labels such as jazz. And as you know, we talk about in the film, he coined this term black classical music because he felt that the music should be on par with European classical music, that the legacy was this great, that it should be given a broader term.
You mentioned his son Rory and his wife Dorothan, and that along with you, all three of you, will be at the screen of the film on Sunday. Really looking forward to it. It's a really, there's a lot of levels to it here in Bloomington because, of course, Rahsaan died in Bloomington, and it's probably the last time she's ever been in town.
Yeah, this is huge for Dorothan, especially because she was with him. And you know, in the film isn't kind of like an A to Z biography where we give you every detail. And though we talk about his death in the film and the night he died, Dorothan discusses it. We don't explicitly say that was in Bloomington, Indiana. So you know, as we're noting here, it definitely was. Rahsaan's last concert, his last night on Earth, was in Bloomington. And for Dorothan, that's really significant. Well, I have to tell you, and Dorothan always says this to me, you know, so there was a student from IU who was driving them to the airport when Rahsaan died. And Dorothan always says, you know, and she tells the story about how they're in the car in the film. She does. Rahsaan basically passed away in the car, and she flipped out, as you would, as you're husband dies right in front of you.
Yeah.
And she said, and she always says to me, you know, I wonder about that student who was driving. He was a nice young man. The poor guy, you know, was driving when this all happened. And I wonder what happened to him. She's always asking about him. So if anyone If whoever that student was is hearing this, or someone knows who that person is, Dorthan is always asking about him or you, and it would be super cool that if that person were to show up. And it's also, you know, this is so Dorthan. Rasan, her husband, dies, but she feels bad for the guy who is driving because he might have shaken him up.
She sounds like the person with the massive amount of empathy who was maybe the only person on Earth that could have handled Rasan's iconoclastic and sort of outside personality. I mean, he was a force of nature, was he not?
Yeah, for sure, for sure. And also she talks about after he had the stroke, how he just kept going. You know, he was on dialysis regularly, at least once or twice a week, you know, draining his blood and putting in fresh blood. And then he would go to a gig. He would get dialysis during the day sometimes and be at a gig at night. So, I mean, just to withstand that. And you know, we've made a lot of medical progress in that area since the 70s. So it was really... He was, as you said, a force of nature.
Get back to another, I think, key factor in who Rasan Roland Kirk was and what he was trying to, how he conceptualized his music, and that was his blindness and didn't necessarily give him superhuman powers, but some people might say so.
He did have
very acute hearing, and paired with Joel Dorn as producer, some very creative productions that had a whole lot to do with sound. And earlier in the interview, I said jazz is not a broad enough term, and especially the album, The Three-Sided Dream. When that came out, it was just fascinating in terms of like a music concrete approach of getting beyond music and just using pure sound for expression.
He always said his occupation was sound. Like, that was what he was into, and he didn't rule music over anything else. He was into the sound of animals and train going by. He might reproduce that on his saxophone. You know, he had records of bird sounds and animal sounds and waves and insects. And so everything was ammunition for him, and certainly that album that we took the name of the film for, The Case of the Three-Sided Dream, I mean, that's just, you know, a phenomenal album. And it's been called the Sgt. Peppers of jazz, and they do some amazing stuff. And it also, you know, breaks out of the kind of straight-ahead jazz terminology. It's much more, for sure.
Rasan Roland Kirk, I command you to go to sleep and dream.
Dream. Oh, what am I going to dream about? I didn't dream all I can dream in life. I'm trying to wake up and live and make some money off dreams that people been making off my dreams. You know, people been there doing everything I dream about.
But your electricity,
no good. You know I ain't going to go for nothing like that. I'll pull the plug out of you, then what's going to be happening? Ain't nothing going to be happening.
We are the ones that been waking up the world.
You don't want me to go to sleep. Pull the plug out of you and you'll be dead.
I got a computer at home that's mean that was invented back in 1930-something. You know, the piano roll, you scared of that computer.
How hip is a computer?
You know, he talked a lot. There's a lot of talking on record, and we wanted to capture that because he had a lot to say. He wasn't light on opinions. And that kind of also brought me to an obstacle, though. You know, film is a visual medium, and if we're going to hear him talking, what are we going to see? So that's what kind of led me to the animation in the film. So I used a lot of those talking passages, and then we had a great artist do some animation over that. So that's a nice component to the film. I wanted it to kind of feel like Rasan also.
That's the real stuff right there, him in the moment talking. And
yeah.
I look forward to seeing those animations to see how you use that as a production element to get those archival recordings in there. Let's really focus on you and the creation of this film. It's been great to talk about your subject. And you mentioned that you bought your first album of his on a whim. Where and when did the spark for the idea of the documentary come?
So, I mean, I think people listening, if they don't know Rassan, they need to know. You know, he really hits, I would almost say if he hits, but I think if you listen, it's 100% given that he's going to hit you. He really hits you in an emotional place. You know, his music is so much feeling. I mean, sometimes it's obfuscated by the theatrics because, and not in a bad way, he was well aware of theatrics he would do, or of the dexterity, or of the monstrous technique. I mean, there's so much going on. But, you know, he really hit me emotionally, as I think he does anybody who listens to him for more than a minute or more than 5 seconds. So it kind of germinated to make the film for a while. I was living in San Francisco when I first got into Rassan, and then I was, you know, a fan and bought records and was into him. But I moved back to New York in 99. I was making films, you know, for a good few years, and I was talking to a friend about Rassan and saying how it's just such an amazing story. I mean, the music is great visually. He's an eyeful. And then, and you know, he had a political agenda, and he had this stroke, and he came back, and his life story is super cool. And I was talking to a friend, and I said, someone should really make a film. I can't believe it hasn't been made yet. My friend said, well, why don't you do it? So, you know, in those days we had phone books, and I looked up Joel Dorn, who was in New York, Rassan's producer, and I told him I wanted to do this, and he said, okay, come over. And so it started with Joel, and he, you know, we talked for a while. He opened up some doors for me. He introduced me to Dorthan, and then got in touch with Steve Turay, and then Joel opened a bunch of doors for me, and the thing kind of snowballed. It took a long time because I couldn't get funding together, and, you know, who wants to fund? I'm sure you know, funding for jazz is scarce, and if something's going to be funded, it's generally, you know, Duke Ellington or Armstrong or Nina Simone or Miles, or, you know, big names. Rassan's not a household name, unfortunately, but we're trying to change that. You know, it kind of snowballed from there, and it germinated for a while, and the project started around the turn of the century, and then it was shelved for a while, and then I picked it back up in about 2012, I would say.
What sort of visual archives did you have access to in terms of documentation of performance, whether that was on film or video?
I had a huge amount. Well, that was one of the obstacles because I had to license most of the stuff, so that's a big price tag. But I wasn't, you know, my main directive was, this is a film about Rassan. We're going to see Rassan, and his legacy is performing and on stage and the music, so we need to see as much of that as possible. So, you know, unlike most quote-unquote music documentaries, there's a lot of music in this film. I didn't hold back. There's a great amount of archives in there, and a lot of it you can see on YouTube now, but some of it you can't find anywhere. And there's some really rare performances. There's a performance of him on the Ed Sullivan Show where he had an all-star band featuring Mingus on bass and Archie Shepp and Roy Haynes on drums. You know, there's the post-stroke footage. And then also Dorthan Kirk gave me some Super 8 home footage that's in the film, so which also makes it very intimate. You know, I wanted it to be more of an intimate, poetic film. Again, it's not a Ken Burns style. He was born X year, and we're going to slowly pan into the photo, and we have a bunch of experts. There's no experts in the film. I mean, everyone's an expert in Rassan because it's only the people that spent years with him. So those people are the experts in this film. But there's a pile of footage, and it spans the 60s. Through 1977.
Rassan was really had a powerful strain of activism.
Yeah.
And in his personality, you mentioned the appearance on the Ed Sullivan Show.
Yeah.
Where basically he pulled one of those things that did not happen very often unless you were at the level of the Beatles or Bob Dylan, where you got invited on the Ed Sullivan Show, and you totally changed it up once you were live and you played something different. I actually saw that when I was a kid. I saw that the night that it was on the air. And so you were able to use that in the film. Maybe if you can describe what happened that night, because he had who? Eric Dolphy and Charles Mingus? And
he had Mingus. It wasn't Dolphy. It was Archie Shepp. Yeah, that was a big kind of inflated chair ready to explode, as Ron Burton might have said. But see, that night, well, Rasson started something that was called the Jazz and People's Movement. And that was, he brought a bunch of musicians together, anyone who was down with the cause, basically, to say there's not enough of this music, black classical music, as he would have called it, did call it. There's not enough of this music exposed on the airwaves, on television. You know, there's lots of pop music and everything else, but there's really a scarce representation of what we know as jazz. So they got all these musicians together, and people were in there, like Lee Morgan was part of that, Billy Harper, and Brasson, of course, led it, and a bunch of other guys. And they would buy tickets to tapings of live TV shows, such as Merv Griffin or Hugh Downs, talk shows of the day. And they would go in, and they would smuggle in instruments, noisemakers, or a pocket trumpet, or bells, whistles. And once the show tried to tape, they would, on a cue from Rasson, the blind guy in the room, they would disrupt the show. They would stand up, they would make noise, the show couldn't tape, and then, you know, a discussion would ensue. Why are these people here? What's the issue? What's going on? So it created a dialogue, which is what they wanted to do. And as a result of that, they did start getting invited on shows. And one of those shows was the Ed Sullivan Show.
And this was in 1968, correct?
This was 71.
Oh, 71, okay. 71.
Sullivan started in the late... Yeah, I mean, they had been doing it at least a year or two up until the Ed Sullivan. They got invited on a bunch of shows after that. One of the shows they disrupted was the Dick Cavett Show as well. But Dick Cavett was a friend to the movement,
right?
It should be said. But so they got invited on Sullivan's show, and then, you know, I believe it's Mark Davis who was in the film, took Sullivan's people around to kind of get them hip to jazz and say, you know, this is jazz, and, you know, this is who you can have on the show. And, you know, Rasson was doing a lot of soul jazz at that time. He was playing, like, Stevie Wonder tunes, Minnie Riperton.
Right.
And so... You know, the Sullivan people said, sure, this is cool, and they gave them a 5-minute spot, which was a big spot, and they told Rasson he could have anyone he wants, but they thought, oh, this soul jazz is cool, so why don't, yeah, it would be cool if he could play My Sharia more. So they agreed to it, and, you know, not to spoil the film, but they didn't follow the program, as you know, so,
right.
You know, the surprise is, well, there's a surprise. It didn't turn out to be My Sharia more that they played, and again, they had, you know, they had a full, like, kicking band. Again, Mingus, not only Mingus on bass, but Rasson kept all his regular musicians on the bandstand, so there were two bass players. There was Metathias, his usual bass player, plus Mingus, Roy Haynes on drums again, Archie Shepp, and Rasson's whole horn section with Dick Griffin on trombone, and Charles McGee on trumpet, and, you know, they had a percussionist, and they came out, you know, with the attitude, actually... This didn't make it in the film, but Mark Davis, who's a friend who was there at the time, he said backstage before the taping, Rasson was getting all amped up, and he kept saying, we're going to burn it down, we're going to burn it down. So, you know, burn it down they did.
Boy, that really is tweaking my memories of that, of sitting in front of the television. You know, I would have been 16 at the time. And was familiar with most of the names on the set, but the energy that came out of the television that night, I had been exposed to some pretty heavy music already, considering the time period, even though I lived in Indiana. I just thinking about that is giving me goosebumps of just what, I mean, it's kind of a Black Lives Matter kind of approach, kind of a flash mob, just show up let's raise some issues.
Sure. Well, you did touch upon one thing that, and at least one person says this in the film, but, you know, talking about energy, I mean, that was, the thing about Rasson is so few people could harness that amount of energy that he did. I mean, he was a ball of fire.
Yeah. Well, you, sir, have done the greater universe quite an honor by documenting the lifetime of this amazing person who had huge obstacles in his life, yet found a way to just keep blasting it out. We're really looking forward to this film coming to Bloomington, looking forward to meeting you and the family in person on Sunday.
I'm definitely looking forward to the screening and meeting up in Indiana, and getting Dorthon back to Indiana will be, it's very meaningful.
I think it'll be a very special night.
Yeah.
Well, Adam, it's been great talking to you, and we're just a few days from having this experience here in Bloomington. It's going to be a good one.
Yeah, looking forward.